So this is the double Thomas splint.
This is the double Thomas.
It does look like a medieval torture device, you would have to say, this double Thomas splint.
Only now looks grotesque, I suppose, but maybe it's the oldness of it, the wear, I don't know. I mean, it doesn't scare me, but I still have a scar on the back from it.
Yeah, we're dug in and laid away in the skin.
Hi, I'm Claire Wright, and this is Shooting the Past, where every picture is worth at least 1,000 words, if not a whole history. As a mother of 3 kids, the eldest now 20, I've had my fair share of worries. Most go with the territory of 21st century parenting, food allergies, binge drinking and the like. But one thing I've never had to fear is whether my children would be struck down by an infectious disease. When I had them all immunised as babies, I didn't even really know what the jab was protecting them from. Just bad stuff that happened in the past, but didn't happen anymore because of this jabbing business. Which is why I find this photograph I'm holding now so chilling. Here is a row of sandy-haired lads lying in hospital beds. They couldn't be much older than 8 or 9. They stare directly at the camera, but no one is smiling. The fellow in the foreground is in a plaster cast from the tips of his toes to the top of his ribcage. He's strapped to a metal stretcher. Drawn by their somber little faces, it takes me a while to realise that these hospital beds are not in a sterile ward, but on a veranda, in the open air. According to the photo's provenance record, it was taken in the 1940s at the Royal Children's Hospital's polio facilities. These boys, like thousands of other children of their generation, are being treated for polio. The photo has me thinking, what would it have been like to spend your childhood trussed up in plaster? And I'm dying to know why this hospital ward appears to be outdoors.
Can we scoot you around, Anne-Marie, so that we're...
Can I scoot myself around?
To help me answer these questions, I head out to the small town of Lockhart in the Riverina district of New South Wales to meet Anne-Marie McLeod. Anne-Marie greets me in her motorised wheelchair at the local historical museum. She was 6 when she crumpled on the bathroom floor one morning.
I was 6 in the January. 1955. God, I've got to count back now. And there was a locum doctor here, and she diagnosed me with mumps, but it seemed to be taking too long to recover. And when the local doctor came back, diagnosed polio, I was at home. I'd gotten up that morning to go to the bathroom, and my right leg collapsed on me, and then Mum realised it was something more than mumps. So Dr. Bill came back around to the house, and I remember it must have been so much of a shock for Mum. I remember her up in the hallway with the doctor, and she was vomiting, and he was consoling her. Only child, waited 10 years to have me, and struck down in, you know, a matter of seconds, 10, 20 seconds.
And you would have no idea where you had picked up the infection?
No idea whatsoever. No idea.
So random.
Exactly.
So can you remember a time when you could walk?
I can. I can remember being in school plays. I was the pig in the brick house. I can remember getting my first push bike.
So Anne-Marie, you were struck down, literally, and diagnosed correctly with poliomyelitis. So what was the next step?
The next step was to get me to Wagga. Infection control. So there was no ambulances around in those days, so no one really wanted to come near us because of the germ factor. We didn't have a vehicle. So my uncle volunteered, my mother's sister's husband, and he had children of his own, and he was warned by the local doctor to take care because he did have his own children, but he just decided that that's what he'd do. There was no one else to do it, so I can distinctly remember lying in the back seat with my head on Mum's lap. Dad was in the front with my uncle and went to Wagga.
So the treatment began in Wagga?
No, nothing began in Wagga. Just left me there in infectious disease until they thought that had passed. Inhumane treatment there, terrible stuff.
Can you describe?
Well, thirst, absolute thirst and nothing to drink. You know, I don't think the staff wanted to come near you either. And I was out on a veranda that was only gauzed in, and whether that was to get the germs out or keep the people away, I don't know. Because Mum and Dad were only allowed to visit 2 hours twice a week, so I was alone.
And so from Wagga, after you were out of infectious diseases?
Mum and Dad had a choice of Sydney or Melbourne. Sydney was the Far West and the Kenny treatment. Melbourne was Dr. Dame Jean McNamara. And because Mum had family and friends in Melbourne, that's where we went, and it was closer.
So off to Melbourne, to the Royal Children's Hospital.
Yeah, well, just for one night. Transported then out to Hampton Rehab.
And it was in the Bayside suburb of Hampton that Anne-Marie could have ended up in a photograph similar to the one we're looking at now. Like the little boys, she spent the next 6 years being pushed and pulled through a series of exercises known as the treatment.
So I'd even had a physio sitting on my bottom while I was on my tummy, and another one lifting my legs back to loosen the muscles in my groin. And
it must have been terrifying for
Well, it was terrifying, but it was very, very painful.
And in the off hours between the exercises, you were in the double Thomas splint?
I was.
The double Thomas splint is this strange contraption that Anne-Marie donated to the Historical Museum. Honestly, it looks like something out of the Middle Ages, not the middle of the 20th century. It's got two metal plates for feet, a rusty steel crucifix across the middle, and leather straps to hold the limbs in place. The double bit means full body, neck to toe.
Look at the foot plates.
Ned Kelly had nothing on this suit of armour.
God, no.
And were there other children in the ward with you?
Yeah, there was 12 beds in the ward, and there was another end to the ward where the boys were, the blue room.
And were you able to mix freely with the boys in any respect, or were you absolutely...
No, only on the verandas when we went out for this sunshine cure.
The sunshine cure. Maybe that's why the boys in this photo are outside. In the photograph, some of the lads are lying on their tummies reading. But could Anne-Marie do something as simple as reading in her double Thomas splint?
The biggest treat in that splint was to have what they called a ramp, which was a piece of sponge sloped, and you could put it under your head. So your head actually came up probably 2 inches, which meant you could hold a book and literally read. So if you were naughty, which I was at times, they'd take the ramp away. Punishment.
Anne-Marie, I have to ask you, what could you do that was naughty when you were tied up in that thing all day long?
Oh, dare people to do things and they do it. And I knew that, there wouldn't be very good repercussions with it all. Yeah, well, never have been terribly bad, but I was probably singing or keeping everybody else awake because I was bored all the time. So they pushed the bed and knocked me up in the schoolroom for the night.
That was your punishment?
That was my punishment.
Did you feel...
All on my own. Yeah, awful.
Pitch black. Solitary confinement.
Nothing. Couldn't do a thing. And I don't know whether it taught me anything, to be honest. I certainly didn't comply too often. And I think that's what got me through polio, was my... not obstinance against authority, but my gut will to get away, get out of this situation and move on.
At the age of 12, after 6 years of the treatment, including 22 hours a day in the double Thomas splint, Anne-Marie made a decision that would affect the rest of her life.
They were trying to get me to walk, hence the crutches there. That was the second pair. And I could, but it would take me half an hour to go a metre. And it was more chance of falling. All sorts of things that made me think that this is not going to work for me. I've got a very fast personality, so I needed to be able to do things more quickly than what walking would enable me to do. So I chose wheelchair. I grew up thinking there wasn't anything wrong with me. I was the same as everybody else.
So do you reckon being part of a small rural community would have actually helped you integrate more?
Absolutely. Even though I was different, I wasn't treated differently. So, I went to school like everybody else. I played sport like everybody else with someone else's help. So,
do you feel like you're a part of a stream of Australian history that has now just washed by?
Until all this came up with the splint, I would never have dreamt that anyone would want to delve into the history of polio or myself.
I'm Claire Wright and this is Shooting the Past on RN. Flying back to Melbourne from Wagga, I couldn't stop thinking about the childhood that Anne-Marie had lived. Not just her personal pain and suffering, but also the fact that a whole nation was terrified by the thought that their child might be the next to succumb to polio. The enemy lurked within.
This is polio, the cruel centuries-old crippler of children. Enlarged 77,000 times, these are actual polio viruses.
The first big documented polio epidemic in Australia was in 1937. There was a drop-off during World War II, but this may have been due to a lack of record-keeping during wartime. There were more big spikes in the mid-1950s, which is when Anne-Marie was struck down. So how common was Anne-Marie's experience of institutionalisation?
My mother had polio, of course.
But I seek out Dr. Carolyn Malkin, who has not only studied the hospital archives, but whose mother also contracted polio as a baby. What does Carolyn see when she looks at the photo of the bedridden boys?
I see, obviously, I see young, I guess the term of the day would be crippled, restrained bodies lying in bed, but I see smiles, I see children, I see them outside, and I know my mother's own experience corresponds with this image as well.
It's interesting that Carolyn sees smiles on the kids' faces, where I see valiant grimaces at best. Maybe Carolyn's mother had a more benign and successful treatment. Maybe the sunshine cure worked. So what exactly is going on the veranda in this photograph?
This photograph, I believe, is one of the open-air heliotherapy wards down at the orthopaedic section of the Royal Children's Hospital at Mount Eliza on the Mornington Peninsula. And heliotherapy means therapy from the sun, and it stems from a late 19th century belief stemming from the treatment of tuberculosis, the idea that sunlight has a negative impact on bacteria. So it was a natural progression that they would assume that that treatment would also be good for young children who were dealing with polio, of course, and osteomyelitis.
And you referred to these children as cripples. Is that the correct term for those kids at the time? I mean, we tend to think of that as quite a pejorative term now, like, a spastic,
yes,
cripple, a retard. What was the correct term for referring to children like this?
Very much cripple, and it was not a pejorative term then. Indeed, it was perfectly descriptive. It was on letterheads, names of organisations, departments.
To Orly Airport, a French airliner brings a cargo of sadness. The passengers are 22 children, 22 cripples, 22 victims of that dreaded scourge, infantile paralysis. By next Christmas, perhaps, they may be home again, cured.
The treatment of the time was restraint, positioning of the limbs in such a restrictive way that would prevent deformity but allow later muscle re-education. But they would go to the beach straight away. Straight away, on their trolleys, on their crutches, in their wheelchairs. It was a strangely highly active lifestyle, which you might not get from this photograph.
And funnily enough, some of these kids might have come from inner city areas and would have never otherwise have seen the beach.
Quite true. And the early days of the Royal Children's Hospital, it was set up for what they call the indigent classes. And the Royal Children's Hospital developed a training centre for youth on the grounds of the orthopaedic section. They called it, strangely, the Craft Hostel.
The Craft Hostel.
Because, like now, we identify that work was so much a part of our well-being, identity and future role in the world. That was seen as the way forward for these young people.
And was that quite a progressive idea?
Indeed it was. And Dr. Douglas Galbraith, who was the medical superintendent at the time, later reflected that he used the Craft Hostel, which was later called the Aftercare and Rehabilitation Unit, for his army rehabilitation work. And later he worked on the Commonwealth Rehabilitation Service, which I think is in some form is still practiced today. And not to draw too long a bow, you can see some remnants of these wonderfully progressive, humane policies in place with the NDIS today.
Well, this is fascinating because, you know, we look at this photo and we look at the treatment these kids received, you know, pictures of the Thomas splint, and it looks positively medieval. We look on these with horror. But what you're saying is that at the time, Australian treatment methods were actually international best practice.
Yes, it is hard to reconcile that looking at this photograph. And I guess I just urge listeners to look at the smiles. This did represent best practice. And if this photograph is taken in the mid-40s, as I think it might be, we were just starting to see the emergence of antibiotics. And we were just starting to see successful treatments for tuberculosis and the emergence of vaccines the next decade. So this was the best there was at that time. And I guess, as back to being an archivist, when I was involved in the closure of some of the institutions in Victoria, caused me to ask my mother again, Mum, you were in a place like that, weren't you? But you said it was wonderful. She said it was. It was the making of me. I wouldn't have been able to have the life I had, independence, work, family, had I not gained that confidence, because I was a crippled girl in a poor family, and it was a loving family, but it could not have given me the resources that I gained access to by being at the Royal Children's Hospital. I was not sent away.
I've got to admit, I'm a bit surprised by what Carolyn's telling me. It's a much more positive and nuanced story than I might have imagined on first glance. It's a story about class and community as much as medical science. It seems it was work and training, not the sun, which gave Carolyn's mum the mobility that polio had stolen from her.
To the University of Michigan campus in 1955 came hundreds of scientists. Heading the medical men was Dr. Jonas Salk, whose polio vaccine had been tested and carefully evaluated. The room was electric with expectancy. Then the historic announcement, the vaccine works.
American virologist Jonas Salk developed an injectable vaccine for polio in 1955, the same year Anne-Marie contracted the disease. The Salk vaccine was replaced by mass immunisation in an oral form in the mid-1960s. I can remember taking this sticky pink liquid on a tiny plastic spoon when I was in primary school. But Australia wasn't declared polio-free until the year 2000, so this isn't ancient history we're talking about here. Polio is no longer a hot-button issue, but its legacy appears to lie just beneath the surface.
It was like the AIDS of its day. You know, people were terrified of it, and people were ostracised because their families had polio.
This is Marianne Lightoff, the National Program Manager at Polio Australia, an organisation that supports polio survivors. I'm keen to hear what a health professional makes of this photograph.
They all look fairly relaxed, and I suppose it's because they've all got each other to talk to, but the reality of it would have been quite harsh, I would imagine. The hospitals of during those polio epidemics were just so packed with children specifically who were recovering from polio that the nurses just couldn't keep up with it. So they were sort of wheeled out into these verandas, come hail, sleet, shine, whatever, and they were just left there all day.
So would these kids have gotten any schooling?
There were tutors that used to come around, and so they did get some form of education, although in Victoria a lot of these kids went on to be schooled further in Eurella. And Eurella was a home for all kinds of children with various disabilities, a lot of them was previously the Crippled Children's Association. And they had children with cerebral palsy, there would have been children with Down syndrome, all kinds of any number of capacity. And one of the things that I get asked a lot is whether people's brains were affected through having polio, and the answer is no. And it's also, what is polio? Thinking that it could be something like cerebral palsy or Down syndrome. But no, it's a virus. And the reason why so many children contracted polio is because they're underdeveloped immune system. So these children with polio were put into classes with people of varying intellectual capacities, and some really missed out on the type of opportunities that they could have had in later life had they had a mainstream education.
I knew that poliomyelitis was a virus, but Marianne tells me something I didn't know. There are two types of the infection: paralytic polio, the typically muscle-contracting version that Anne-Marie and Carolyn's mum had, and non-paralytic polio, which only manifests in later life. But what does this distinction mean for polio victims in Australia today?
Now they're all ageing, and those who had paralytic polio at least have some kind of record that they had paralytic polio. Years of having a residual disability is impacting on their mobility often. And the ones who had non-paralytic polio are also getting muscle weakness, but they go along to their doctor, and the criteria that you need for a diagnosis of what's known as post-polio syndrome, right, which is a specific syndrome, clearly identifies that you must have had paralytic polio. So if you can't say that you had paralytic polio, you know, often the doctors are not able to give you a diagnosis. The fact is that if you're experiencing new physical weakness or pain, and it's a result of the condition that you survived as a child, I think that all that's got to be taken into account, which is why we use the umbrella label, I suppose, for want of a better word, of the late effects of polio, because we believe that everybody, no matter what polio level they had, will be experiencing some form of the late effects of polio, even if it's not medically diagnosable as post-polio syndrome.
For me, this photo of broken little boys on a sunny veranda has shed light on an episode in Australian history that was oddly obscured by the remarkable success of medical science. Yet there are still thousands of people walking around in Australia today under the shadow of polio. Why do we hear so little about them? Why has it been so easy to forget?
One of the biggest things is that, once again, people are sort of told to pack it away, get on with their lives, and don't think about it again. That is like a mantra for polio survivors. You know, we just got on with it. But there's definitely, you know, a lot of people that get depressed because they thought that they'd beat it. You know, they licked this thing and they got on with it, and they did all the things that, you know, that they were told that they should be getting on and doing. And now it's coming back to haunt them.
What do you think the polio history has to teach us about our past?
The anti-immunisation thing really bugs me. Really bugs me. I can see no sense in why people think that there's any benefit in not being immunised. I mean, have a day in that, in the splint, and see if you'll immunise your kids or not. And if they're not careful, some of these things are going to come back.
Anne-Marie, it's been an absolute pleasure meeting you. I've learnt so much.
I
feel both horrified by what you've had to experience, both because I'm seeing this splint in front of me and just trying to imagine my own 12-year-old daughter strapped in this thing for the last 6 years, and also heartened to hear your story of, well, you know, it's patronising to say survival. You've lived a great life.
I have, with no regret.
If you or someone you know might be suffering from the effects of post-polio syndrome, you can get information and support from Polio Australia. You'll find links on the Shooting the Past website, where you can also view the photograph of the little boys taking their sunshine medicine. And don't forget, you can leave your comments on the website too. My thanks to Anne-Marie McLeod, Carolyn Malkin, and Marianne Lightoff. Thanks also to the staff at the Lockhart Historical Museum. You can view a video of Anne-Marie and the double Thomas splint she donated to the museum on the Shooting the Past website. This episode of Shooting the Past was produced by Michelle Rayner, with production assistance by Lynn Gallagher and sound engineering by Brendan O'Neill. In the next episode of Shooting the Past, I'll take you to a different hallowed ground, the MCG, where I'll introduce you to an Aussie rules footballer and the photograph that made him a celebrity. And don't forget, you can download the whole series of Shooting the Past at ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.